Hey, I'm Jeremy Utley.
And I am Mara Christensen. Welcome to the Paint on iPad podcast.
I'm the father of four daughters, and I've got blind spots. I know what the world is like from my perspective, but I don't know what it's like from theirs. So I set out with my friend, Mara Christensen, to understand the perspective of female founders from a range of diverse industries and cultural backgrounds. I'm excited to have you on the learning journey with us as we dive into these amazing conversations.
All right, let's get started.
In this episode, we talk with Ellie Buckingham and Miri Buckland, co-founders of The Landing, about how they decided to become entrepreneurs and how they found each other as co-founders. We speak with them about preserving the quest mentality on a small team and how to know when to pivot in the early stages of building a business. We also talk with them about daily practices that they employ to fuel their own creative practice and mindset. And we talk with them about their innovative tactic of building a power user design council to make sure they're getting rapid feedback on product iterations.
Well, we have a lot of exciting things to brainstorm around because we have our first week of like real user data in our new product.
Oh my gosh, so exciting.
And it's so exciting.
It's so cool. People are making stuff that is whack and really exciting and fun. So we just, there's a million ideas trying to kind of corral them all.
Like Ellie's mood board, you can see here.
It's an amazing document. So is that a user-generated content or did you make that?
This is a me-generated content. I have been, since we launched, on a mission to do a daily morning mood check-in.
I love that. I'm going to go and do one, you know?
Yeah, please do.
Go check it out. But it's kind of for multiple purposes. One is like trying to make fetch happen for people, you know, modeling, sharing of something from The Landing every day, but also just like really, really like actively using the tool every day. And the best part about it is this realization that it's actually like really positively contributing to my mental health.
I bet.
Like this time in the morning when it's like all I have to do is drink my coffee and make something weird.
And do you actually block it on your calendar? I mean, is it like legitimately a priority or how do you prioritize it, I guess is my question.
It's like my number one, it's the thing I can do before anything else every morning.
She doesn't open WhatsApp or Slack until she's done it, which is actually a great forcing function.
It's like a digital journal or something.
Yeah. I mean, I can share my screen and show you guys. My collection now is after a week. So fun. It's like this visual, like what I have been doing and thinking each, like they're all different. They're just whatever kind of catches. This was for Miri's birthday. Hold on.
Oh my gosh. You'll recognize me in a storage unit.
That's awesome.
This was like on lingerie. So I'm really digging it.
That is super
cool. I love it. You know who's going to like it? My daughter. She's really going to like it.
Well, you know, it's interestingly enough, it's totally on point for part of the conversation. So just backing up a level, Mara and I were talking. I was kind of sharing with Mara, hey, I'm a father of four daughters who I want to have, you know, limitless, I see as having limitless potential and want them to have limitless opportunity to realize that potential. I know that there's many things I don't know. And I just told her I'd like to set out a journey of learning what I don't know, at least so that I can be a better father and a better encourager, you know, of their creativity and their entrepreneurial, you know, visions and things like that. And she said, wow, let's talk to some founders. That'd be fun. So one of the things I'm really curious about is how does one attend to their creative practice on a regular basis? And you just kind of served up this gem, which is before I open up anything else, I prioritize it. Miri, I'd be curious for you. Do you have a similar or different practice or how do you think about attending to that part of yourself and your professional personal life?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because for me, it like looks different, you know, month to month. And even like, I feel like I go through real like different trends almost of like what it means for me to be creative. Like during the beginning of quarantine, I started playing the piano, which I played when I was younger. And I was like, okay, this is just a great thing for me to get off the screen and like not be looking at, you know, Netflix or my computer or whatever it is when I'm trying to relax. More recently, I've been just like making sure that, you know, the last thing I do before bed is something that isn't on my screen, like reading a book or, you know, talking to somebody on the phone, And then like it really goes in waves. And I actually think that like work plays a big part in my creativity at the moment. I think partly because part of my job is like creating rewards for one, but also seeing what other people create and watching them create things, you know, throughout all of our user research and stuff that we do. And so for me, it actually like really does fulfill quite a lot of my creative needs in a way, because we get to have so much fun while we're like working on the product and researching it.
That's great. One of the founders we were talking with, actually, Mara, was right after you dropped off the line last time, but I was asking, how do you know when you have an idea problem? And founder we were speaking with said, what do you mean an idea problem? I said, well, there's problems where we need to execute. And the problem is refining, iterating, you know, implementing. But then there's other times where I go, I don't know what the answer is. And that's what I call an idea problem, right? And I actually need a totally different mindset and draw on a different set of tools. And she's a very successful founder and a very accomplished woman. And I thought she's going to have a very put together answer. And you know what she said? She goes, whoa, there's like five problems I'm struggling with that I didn't realize were idea problems. And so to me, it's kind of an interesting topic that we just kind of stumbled onto last time. But how do you become aware of when you have an idea? Is there a moment where a flip gets switched where you go, we actually need to be in a different mindset right now?
I was just going to say, like, I often don't think it's actually myself. Like, I don't think I notice it myself that I have an idea problem. Cause I think sometimes we can be so in like execution mode that we're like, okay, we think this is the thing we need to do. And we're just going to like, go, go, go. I think it's often when we have like either external conversations with people we're updating on something we're talking about, or when we're bringing in someone else on our team to a problem or a project we're working on, that they can be like, see the forest for the trees and say, you know, like, is this actually the right avenue even to be going down? Like, let's step back to the idea phase and like discuss at that level first. So I think sometimes it takes just like a different person in that conversation if we haven't noticed it ourselves.
I'm curious how the two of you, it's so interesting because the two of you, I consider both fairly creative people, but how do you guys complement each other and help, I guess, solve some of these idea problems or come up with them?
I think we both, this is actually a really funny anecdote, but it ties in. One of the classes we took together when we were at the GSV during our second year was a meditation class, which of course only at the GSV. But the first prompt in the class was super open-ended and it was literally draw your brain. That was it.
Oh my God.
It was like take a paper and draw your brain. And like the actual imagery of like my drawing versus Miri's drawing is the perfect encapsulation of like the way that we work really well together, which is like Miri's was the most beautiful structured, like series of squares, series of circles, and then straight across them. And mine was like an absolute, it looked like slime with like energy things coming off of it and weird. Yeah, just kind of all over the place. So I think that we think differently, but we've worked now long enough together where we kind of know that we think differently. And so can like almost sometimes play the like extreme role in our lane to then like surface as many, like as wide of a range of answers as possible. Cause like we definitely have a pretty shared vocabulary from shared experience and like shared problem solving at this point. But I think it helps us like push out on the bounds of the ways that we think differently.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have also a co-founder, quote, quote, and I feel we're very different. Like you guys, I think we haven't done the exercise of the brain drawing, but I should. Yeah, that's going to be a surprise for him. But I sort of feel that having somebody opposite, you know, different makes you stretch yourself a lot. Anyway, so that's sounds like it's the same for you guys.
I would love to hear, is there a time where the difference has been a particular point of amplification where you remember, wow, I'm so glad we're seeing this so differently. Ellie, you're already laughing. So
no, I'm just laughing like every day. It's not like it's just, I think it comes up in like creative problem solving, but I also just think it comes up in like being able to really like delineate like lanes and the types of decisions where it's like, Miri, you're the best person to make this type of decision versus like where the like more suited person to have like more of a say on it. And I don't know, I'm struggling with specific examples, but I'm laughing because it feels like every day.
It does. It feels like every day, but I think like the example I'll give is that I feel like sometimes Ellie's like mode of thinking or the way she drew her brain can really help me stay in like ideation phase for longer. And I think like one thing that I have noticed a tendency myself is to go straight into like, you know, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to structure it. This is how we're going to get from A to B. And I think like Ellie and other members on our team have helped me really like stay, get more comfortable staying in ideation and thinking of all the possible options before we actually start moving.
And Miri helps me make sure that we actually get stuff done.
Just, I'm a book nerd. I'm a history nerd. You may not have known that about me. It's a confession. I feel like we're in a safe place. I can tell you that. But I think about Bell Labs, which is a very nerdy thing to do. But, you know, where they're literally inventing the transistor and the bit of information and satellite. And one of the characteristics of that environment was there were experimental physicists and there were theoretical physicists. And there's a lot of examples there where a theoretical physicist is on the blackboard and they're saying, here's what the formulas say should happen. And then the experimental physicists are at the breadboard and they're running the experiment going, that said 1500 amperes, I'm getting 100 amperes right here. And then the theoretical physicist is going, wait, okay, hang on, you know, and there's this interplay, which is, I find it to be an incredible example of how innovation really happens. And I'm just kind of hearing that in you guys, you know, that Ellie keeps me in the safe place of ideation longer. And then Ellie's saying, yeah, but Miri keeps me in the place of getting things done, right? How does the commissioning happen? Or how do you know when to go into which? Are we in theory here? Are we ideating? Are we experimenting and executing? What are the cues that let you all know which is the proper mode to be in?
I think a kind of specific example of this is even just structuring a product roadmap and thinking about what the kind of like big picture, huge ideas, what we're going towards, but then the actual like nitty gritty of what we like have to prove each week. And so I think in some ways, like that sort of switch of when we go from ideas into tactical is like largely informed by how like well we've like uncovered the hypotheses around what that specific thing is doing or aiming for. So like an example of this would be, we're thinking about discovery. Like how does a user on the landing, like discover, what does it mean to discover? Where does discovery happen? Like what actually is discovery? Is it of boards? Is it of items? Is it of other people? Like, is it of community? Like huge questions. And we're still pretty like ideation phase there and like definitely not ready to move into the like hyper tactical.
I think that's a really interesting one because I think one way we kind of, I'm just reflecting on how we actually like do that in practice is a lot of what I do is like talking to our users, looking at how they're using the tool, looking at the data, like bringing a lot of the like, what can we find and what can we learn facts to Ellie and the rest of the product team who are in a kind of like, okay, how do we take what we know and translate that into design? And so it's like that kind of like flow of information and creation almost that like feels like we've naturally fallen into that pattern rather than it being something that we thought about as like theory versus experimentation.
It's not codified, you're saying. But what are the mechanisms? Like when you hear something from a user, how does it hit the level, how does it surpass the threshold where you say, I got to tell Ellie this, right? Versus some stuff you probably go, I don't want to waste your time. How do you distinguish between the two?
Yeah, a lot of it is like, a lot of it's a judgment call because it's like, you know, a small user base of users right now, but it's like, how passionately, how often am I hearing this happen again and again? How like passionately do I think, do people really care about it? And how much of a difference do I think it's going to make to the end user experience? And then like Ellie and product team are thinking much more about, okay, how do we prioritize that within the roadmap? Like what would the solution actually look like? And what do we think it should be? Rather than just doing exactly what a user says that they need, which isn't often exactly what we actually want to build.
I have a question related to that because I work with people like you guys that are so early and they go through the company story, the product, everything changes and they, you know, it's called pivots by some people, but I think it's just, you know, transitions on the way. I'd love to hear, I mean, for you guys, I've known your company for a while. I think I've missed a couple of steps, but I know the product has changed. How do you, this, you know, have decided through those major transitions and, you know, what sort of, I know it's a very emotional, not completely rational decision at some in some way. That'd be super helpful, I think, to hear from you guys on that.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, talk about pivots. I feel like transitions is a much better word because there have been so many pivots at this point that I don't know which way round we'll be facing. But I think it's like just that. A lot of our mindset, thanks to everything we learned at Launchpad, has been really about really fast experimentation. And so we're never really like focused on building something in silo and not getting feedback on it. So, you know, we launched our original product, which was much more focused on furnishing last June. And before that, we'd been testing it. As soon as we launched it, we were like testing it and calling up users and like trying to understand what they really thought about it. And a lot of what we learned was really through just like speaking to people and then watching videos of them using the tool. And so that's how we really built a lot of conviction around what people wanted versus what we had created. And that was really around the social aspect that Ellie was talking about. So people wanted a tool that was much more flexible than just home furnishing, but they also wanted something that was social and where they could share designs and see other people's designs. And we were told that time and time and time again. And we also felt it ourselves, like we're the users of this product too. And we knew that like we would have so much more fun and be able to create so much more if we could share and see what other people were doing.
I think in some ways too, this year was like the perfect jumpstart to embedding an attitude of like nothing is sacred into the company culture, because nothing went sacred this year. Nothing went like you planned. Everything changed. And I think for us, so many of like the forcing functions of COVID and things that didn't work were like the building blocks for then what we learned to pull the strings on what was seeming to work or what could work. And in some ways, I think this like quest mentality of the team continues today. Like we're so excited about the product we have in the world, but it's just like the start. It's nowhere near, it's not the fully magic thing yet, but we're like, we feel a little bit closer. We're like, we're getting there. And I think in some ways, like the forcing function of a wild year just put into perspective, like how quickly the world can change and how flexible we
are. Like it gave you permission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, we're not moving people in. It's not happening.
I like that.
Okay. You said the quest. And I don't know if that was just like an offhand, you know, characterization. It felt to me like that's something that you've thought about. And I would love to hear more about what does the quest mean? How do you know if you're getting close? You said we're getting closer. How do you know? That's a word actually I haven't heard anyone use before in the same way. And it's like, it really struck me.
Okay, well, shout out to one of our former teammates, Allison, who came up with the quest mentality, and it has really stuck with our team. Yeah, we love it. And it, in a way, it like has been the ultimate like phrasing and terminology for us to apply to not just like what we're doing as a company as a whole, but like anything we run into, people like framing it as a quest makes it so much more fun. But I think like, you know, at this really early stage, we are still searching for like product market fit. That is what we're going after. And I think that acknowledging it as a kind of quest and like this journey that just requires like constant testing, learning, small iterations to get closer and closer to product market fit is what allows our team to move really quickly and to feel like we're going after a common shared goal, even if we don't really know what product market fit looks like right now. So for us, it's really just like, I think it's really embedded in the culture of the team as a way we approach, you know, everything from product road mapping to solving bugs to where we see ourselves in, you know, a year's time.
It sounds like that was a former employee. And I feel like somebody like that, you can't let leave. So you need to reach back out to Allison.
Where's Allison?
She's pursuing actually building her own furniture, which is awesome. So
I love that.
Yeah. So that's very supportive of that.
So probably last time we spoke, maybe it was, I don't know, 2 months ago or maybe longer. We spoke recently. And one of the things that you mentioned to me, which I thought was a really great practice, and I'd love for you to share, whether it's just for my daughters or for other entrepreneurs or whatever, I don't know. But I'd love to hear more about your, I can't remember the title you give it, but something like a user board of directors or advisory board, or would you tell more about that practice and what they do and how you structure it and why you've done that?
Yeah. So it is actually ballooned into even more in the forefront of what we're doing. So originally, I think last time we spoke, we had just stood up what we were calling at the time our design council. It was a group of five like super, super users who were our sort of newly minted target demographic of like an aesthetically inclined individual who has a multifaceted interest set and is really excited about visually articulating their ideas and has been like hacking together different ways to do so in the past. So we had one woman who's like a real estate agent and a design influencer. We had another guy who was a set designer and an architect and a plant parent. But we basically brought this group into our Slack, like our team Slack channel, and we sent them questions and ideas and got product feedback from them and hopped on the phone with them. And the idea was basically like cultivating this smaller group of like kind of an extension arm of our team for all things kind of product feedback and the like. We have since really sort of like ballooned our community efforts. And when we launched this new version of the product last week, we launched our landing founding community, which is actually a separate Slack. It's 40 members now. So like a much broader group of this kind of target demographic, and is kind of like a multi-purpose vehicle, both to jumpstart our community and social, like socialization around our visual product before we have that built in our actual product, like the social features built. Mm-hmm. But it's really also to like from here on out, co-create like every part of the product with our users. It's been amazing so far. Actually, it's like super fun. People are sharing designs and asking questions and like posting tips. And we're already seeing like individual members of like this community like rise to the top and answer other people's questions. And it's only been live for a week. So honestly, shout out our teammate Liz, who's been kind of an all-around player for us over the last year. She's done everything. She's like taken on this full community hat and has stood up this like amazing program. And we're just the amount of like qualitative and quantitative data that we now have from this group. It's like the volume is almost, it's like almost more than we can really like handle, which is amazing. So I'll stop there. I know Miri has, we're all really excited about it.
I love the word co-create designs, the co-create. Actually a great way to describe a relationship with a customer or a user. It's awesome. And I know it's really hard to build this community. So the fact that you have it, you know, active, and, you know, I'll have to join and see what people are talking about. But I wonder what you owe the success, maybe the fact that it's so authentic and you really believed in it from day one. Because everybody wants to have a community, but it sounds like yours is, really comes from the founders.
If you had to speculate or hypothesize as to what are the, say somebody wants to launch a design council, what are the elements they must include? If you want a vibrant design council as not only a place to share new ideas, but a vibrant community that is inspired by and pushing your ideas, what are the key ingredients there? Is it setting up Slack so they have direct access to the team? Like, what made it special?
That's such a good question. I think we put a lot of thought into who the right people were for that group to begin with. We had spoken to a lot of these people before, had many conversations with them before, just because they were like super users on our original website, or, you know, we've been connected to them through other people, and they were already giving us a ton of really, really helpful feedback. So it was quite an organic transition for those people to then become part of the design council to begin with. I think the second thing that we did that worked well was that we introduced them to each other. Like, those were people who wanted to meet each other and had many shared interests. And so it was really fun for them to kind of like vibe off each other and off the team to share ideas. We also realized very quickly that there's a lot of interest in just like what is going on at a really early stage startup. So just being as transparent as we could with them about, you know, the challenges we were facing, things we were working on behind the scenes, you know, all of that side of things, because the people we were talking to are creators and entrepreneurs in their own right. And they were really interested in seeing how we were running the team and funding and everything else that we were kind of doing as a company. So that was something that we really felt like we could offer back to them, as well as, you know, co-creating a tool that hopefully would be a really great fit for what they were doing.
That's really cool. I love that transparency, actually making people feel like they're a part of the team. Truly, you aren't putting on a front. They're coming in the back door, so to speak. They see the messy kitchen, yeah, all that.
Yeah, the company Slack.
The odd is that we made some mistakes for sure in the beginning of standing up this Slack. And I think the biggest one was a mismatch of like give versus take. We had a really structured approach in the beginning asking for feedback. We would send these like weekly asks that had a Loom video with a whole set of questions. And it was like really structured. And it was just too much. It was like too long of an assignment. It felt like homework. I think what we realized is that the like quick hit, more consistent conversation of like, what do you think of this? Or like, I just made this, like, tell me what you think, or this or that. Like the really kind of like quick and more consistent interaction started to feel way more natural, and also just like engaging. Like our ability to get feedback increased substantially when we went away from this like longer format, like once a week situation, and into a more sort of like, come as you are, there's going to be a bunch of these. So just like hop in whenever you feel like contributing.
To my take as a give, one of the things I've observed in my own life and practice interacting with people is typically the shorter I make the ask, the higher the likelihood of a yes. Right? And it's exactly opposite my instinct, because this thing is so important. I need to explain why it's important, and I need to reinforce it with arguments, and I need, and it's like, you know, but then if I look at my own, how I interact with email, the longer the thing is, the one, the less likely I am to read it. But then two, the more of a burden it seems like, because I got to learn all this stuff, right? But somebody's like, I noticed the other day as another, you know, give, a friend of mine who teaches with me at the D school texted me one line, experiment, colon, I'm hosting a Clubhouse discussion right now. Want to join?
Mm.
And for me, whatever, I don't know why, but the framing of it as experiment, it's like, I just hit the link. Whereas if he had emailed me and said, hey man, I'm thinking about hosting a Clubhouse conversation, it's like, you can't get on my calendar, right?
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, he just texted me, experiment, want to join? I'm like, I mean, I just finished my workout. I'm making a protein shake. And now I'm in this Clubhouse room that I would have like debated, you know, whatever. But to me, like what really spoke to me was the tactic of reducing the perceived commitment is a spectacular way to draw people in.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I don't know how to reach you, Jeremy.
Yeah,
exactly. One line text, I'm yours. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the other thing we found, especially in the Slack, is like engaging people at the right moment, you know, when they're in the right headspace for it. And so a lot of what we've seen, even this is so early, but you know, when you're commenting soon after someone's posted a mood board, and then there's kind of like a back and forth that happens because they've just posted it and you kind of like caught them at the time when they're like thinking about it and in that kind of like creative state. And so it's like, it is actually a bit of an art to find like when you even want to engage with them and when's the kind of like best moment.
But that's great. Fun. That's huge.
Yeah.
Totally.
Can I ask take it a different direction? Mara and I, just before y'all joined the call, we were just talking about siblings and the trust and the aligned values that siblings share and how important that is to founder teams. You all aren't, you know, technically siblings, I know, but there's clear value being alignment between the two of you. I'd love to hear, how did you find each other and how did you know you wanted to undertake an entrepreneurial life together?
I feel like we're basically married.
Pretty much our siblings by now.
We're like some weird combination of like siblings, married, like parents.
Co-parents.
I feel like for us, it was really a like slow roll where we just like didn't stop. So we met at the GSB. Our first real interaction together was actually a super long car drive because we were too cheap to buy plane tickets down to the desert in Southern California. And it was just the two of us. And Miri had her first In-N-Out burger, which was huge. But we like talked and got along really well for an extremely extended period of time, which was like a good first sign. But I think more than that, we started working on a bunch of different ideas, saw both of you all through that like period of time. And I think we had just like a shared respect and appreciation for like what the other person brought to the table, but also just like a super core, very, very, very simple, shared sort of like best intent and like just be a good person type of attitude. And it was like not something we necessarily articulated in the beginning, but I think it was like the, it was probably the core reason why we just never really stopped working together. And there was like a point, I think in the spring, where we're like, I guess we're doing this. we'd rather do this than something else. So,
yeah. The only thing I would say is that, like, to Ellie's point about like, we just never really stopped. I think that was one of the biggest like proof points for both of us, was that we were like so committed to it. And like Ellie's resilience and grit was just like proven to me like time and time and time and time and time again, without her, you know, ever having to say it. It's not like we had a conversation about that and we were like, great, you've got grit, me too, like let's go. It was just like compounded over time, and like still is, to really build that trust between us.
I think it's a very special relationship when these co-founders work, right? It's hard to describe because you're quite not married. It's not a friendship. It's a different type of relationship. And yeah, it's great. Been fortunate to have one. And it's really what you describe, you know, never stops. But in complete, I don't know how you, if you would say this, but I think I heard it. You have this trust, this high trust that you know that if Mary's doing something, she's not going to do it. And, you know, if Ellie's doing something, she's going to get it done. I think that goes a long way. I don't know if there is a better way to explain it.
No, I think that's exactly it. And it's like, you can trust not just like the tasks or the things that someone's going to execute on, but it's like you trust somebody to, you know, take that emotional weight off you.
Yeah.
To bear that like together and kind of protect each other from things, because there's so much always being thrown at you and so many ups and downs that you really have to have that trust that the other person is going to, you know, be operating with best intent and like really have your back and just like take as much as they can, and kind of like an equal partnership in both the emotional side of things and the execution.
Yeah, I agree with you. I almost think that trust is the number one ingredient for speed and, you know, success. Yeah. In startups. It's great. You know, maybe we can, I know you've probably asked this 50 times, but since we're talking to women leaders, I think it'd be great. I think Jeremy knows I'm not even sure where these conversations are going, but I read somewhere in one of a Medium article that somebody interviewed you, that you felt that being women also gave you superpowers. So I'd love, maybe you can elaborate on what superpowers do you have that, you know, you've taken advantage of.
I think one of the things that I have seen over the last few months that has actually felt like a superpower is this like gravitation towards amazing investors who are just really good people. Like, I think there's an interesting sort of like funnel or weeding out of people who on the investing side, like really are passionate about supporting female-led companies, and they themselves are building their firms and the way that they operate around that, that I think like it was not necessarily like an outright goal, but it has proven out, I think, that it was like in some ways an interesting forcing function. I think the other thing that's been cool is that it's like allowed us to like resonate with a pretty diverse group of potential teammates and hires. We like have the benefit of having like different types of people already on the team. And whether it's, you know, a female-led company or a BIPOC-led company or some like amazing mix of those things, I think it like honestly gives us a leg up on the hiring side.
You know, both of those things, like, I completely agree. I think like, I don't know if this is necessarily a gender thing, but I think it's like the intuition and on both the people and the product side of things, and also the empathy of just being able to put yourself in the shoes of so many different users or teammates or partners or anybody. And I don't know whether even 6 months ago I would have said that that was a superpower that I had or we had necessarily as a team, but it's something that I've definitely learned to recognize over the last few months, especially.
I read that you said a woman disruptor was different from a male disruptor. I wonder how they're different. I don't know if you recall yourself saying that, but if there's different ways to disrupt or execute the disruption.
I don't even remember which one of us said it.
I'm like, what?
Tough question. Somebody told you you were coming to get tested.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. It's, I mean, maybe I'll make it simple. I think that men disrupt differently or act differently. And, but I don't want to say what I think.
I think I can answer from the perspective of an anecdote from one of our investors, because it's really hard for me to like really be as much in the mindset of a like male disruptor. It's like complete speculation based on, because I have like a high level of experience on my own experience and pretty low level of experience on others. But I think this is like a really actually interesting anecdote and one that stuck with me. One of our investors, she's amazing. And she always has this joke where she's like, I literally love investing in women, because she's like, obviously the imposter syndrome is something we all need to work on. Like, we're consistently working on it. But like, I have like a high degree of faith that when I have a meeting with a woman who's telling me XYZ, that it's like, that's actually probably the less impressive stat than what's actually happening, versus like on net, there is like a level, I think, of confidence that is like maybe not always as present on the female presentation side of things, but that under the surface belies actually like really interesting information. And I think it's like, obviously any of these like conversations or comparisons are just gross generalizations.
Because of course.
And also, you know, 2021, gender's a construct, but like, I do think that there is something, there's like a nugget of truth there that I think on the flip side, Miri and I have thought a lot about how we can like improve our confidence and get over our imposter syndrome of being first-time founders and like showing up in a room and never having done this before. So I think it goes both ways, but that's my total like slithery answer out of actually answering you.
How you work on your
experience.
What's that? If somebody wants to work on imposter syndrome, what do you think what works for you? I actually have given some advice to folks that worked for me, but I think there's different tactics for getting over it.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It's something that we're like always working on. I think for me, it comes down to ripping the band-aid off the first time I have to do something and then doing it again and again and again and again until I feel like, oh, I've actually done this 10 times. I'm not an imposter. I like just, you know, tell yourself you've done it 10 times. It's been great. I think the other thing to Ellie's point is like we've surrounded ourselves purposely with people who we really, really trust and people who have seen these things, you know, 100 times before and whose input we get before we're trying to do something that's like absolutely brand new to us. And so that always gives me a little bit more confidence of like, I'm not going into this completely alone. I'm going into this as someone who has consulted experts and I feel like we're going in together. And that always helps me personally.
I would just say, I also wrestle with imposter syndrome. I mean, I've been teaching at the D School for the last 11 years, and I'm just waiting for somebody to be like, give us back our swing line stapler kind of a situation. So I don't know if it ever goes away, but I've kind of made peace with it in a way. But I really actually appreciate, Miri, what you said about do it 10 times, you're not an imposter anymore. I think that's profoundly wise. And what distinguishes an imposter from a doer is just at-bats, it's cycles. And you're just saying, undertake the cycles necessary to eliminate it. I'm no longer an imposter, which I think is great.
The instruction to follow.
Right, exactly. Repeat, rinse, repeat. One thing that I wanted to cover before we wrapped up the conversation is, how did you know you wanted to set out an entrepreneurial journey to begin with? I feel like one of the things that you guys talked about was you're in the car together, you start talking on ideas. And So that kind of got to the partnership part of it. But what we haven't really touched on is the entrepreneurship part, which is, it seems a little bit like it was a foregone conclusion for both of you that you wanted to do something, you know, not take a job maybe, but actually build something. How did you come by that desire, interest for yourself?
I think this is actually so interestingly connected to the imposter syndrome conversation, because I think for both of us, and I can very much speak for myself, but kind of for Mary, I think for both of us, it was like always the pipe dream. It was like, that would be so sick. That sounds amazing. That is like the life I would love to lead. Uh-huh. And like, the exploration and just doing something sounds amazing. And if I'm being completely honest, when I came to business school, I was like, I'm not smart enough. I'm not creative enough. I don't know enough. I've never done this. I've never actually worked at a startup. I don't really know what I'd be working on. And I think the combination of like, A, finding someone really to work on something with, but B, kind of this like rip the Band-Aid 10 times, rinse and repeat situation of like, we saw so many people come in to speak at the GSB that were founders and they were, you know, amazing in their own right. They had super interesting stories, but like, you know, with the exception of a few true geniuses, like they were just normal people. The only difference between us and them was that they just did it and they didn't stop. They just like kept going. And it was almost like seeing these really normal people get up who had done crazy stuff. And it was just because they kept doing it. In some ways, that was like the permission or the like the flip from this idea that like we couldn't do it to like, well, like if we can't, like who's going to do it if we're not going to do it? Like we might as well try.
It reframed what I would call a real job, I think. Seeing people come in again and again, I was like, oh, this could be my real job, this thing I've been working on all year.
So you're saying it wasn't actually until business school and hearing from entrepreneurs that it became a legitimate possibility or a legitimate track of exploration, even for you?
I mean, I think,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it was like the dream track, but it wasn't, like, it wasn't necessarily the foregone conclusion. I think for me as well, from like a personal perspective, I had a really tough year, like summer between my 2 years of business school. My dad passed away and it was like this whole sort of like, what am I even doing with life? And that was also, I think, a really big like forcing function of like really reframe on risk tolerance. It was like, in some ways, it made me really define the risk of like not trying. Because like, you know, a life cut short is like, think of all the things that weren't tried. So I think in some ways that was like a very, that was a formative, I think, addition to the reframe. And I think the combination of those, at least for me, was like the kind of pushing factor.
Almost as I keep on going and permission to do and fail is part of it.
The only thing I'd add is that from my perspective, I haven't really articulated this before, but similarly, I felt like, you know, I was, you know, on my British passport, I'm an immigrant technically to the US. And I was like, I have a year, right? I have a year on this visa. Like, let's try it. Let's see what happens. Like, what else am I going to do with that year that would be as exciting and as like give me as much growth as doing this? And if it works, then I'll figure out a way to extend that visa and it'll all be fine. But to me, that was actually in a weird way, a helpful kind of time construct to think about and a forcing function for me to like take the risk and feel brave enough to do that.
It's incredible. I feel like you all just kind of like teed us up for conversation number two to be had at some point in the future, because there's so much more that we could dive into. I'm truly appreciative for your honesty, for your vulnerability, for your willingness to share, to educate me and hopefully others as well. So thank you.
There's so much great information in this conversation, I feel. Actually, not just philosophical, but really actionable that somebody can take and go do.
Maybe just to give you one last opportunity to plug the landing. If somebody doesn't know where to find you, how to find you, why to find you, what would you say?
Why?
The Landing 2.0. It is a social design platform that allows everyone to create together. You can find us at thelanding.app. And on the landing, you can create mood boards, you can remix designs, you can express yourself visually and share it with your friends. So come check us out.
Awesome. Thanks for listening today. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. Can't wait to catch you on the next episode of the Paint and Pipette Podcast.
I will see you next time.